This is my final lecture as Professor of Poetry here at Oxford. Those of you who have attended all 12, I know there are one or two of you, are probably due some kind of reward or recompense. You certainly have my gratitude. Thank you very much for your support. Over the past 4 years, I've focused on individual poets, individual poems, and poetic techniques as a way of discussing the construction and reception of poetry, and have used this platform as an opportunity to broadcast some of my own preferences and prejudices on the subject, as both a reader and a writer. I want to end by making a series of more general observations about the role of poets and poetry within the education system, from school to university level. One of my persistent or underlying themes over this professorship has been the problematic relationship between the specialist artist and the non-specialist audience. The position of poets and poetry in the classrooms, workshops, and lecture halls of the land is absolutely pertinent to that issue, and therefore to poetry's well-being in the present day and the near future. In 1994, I was named as one of the 20 poets in what had been identified as an original poetic movement in the UK, dubbed the New Generation. In truth, we weren't all that new and weren't all of the same generation. Most of us had never met or communicated, let alone hatched a plan to revolutionize literature. In keeping with the marketing culture of the era, the initiative was partly a publicity ploy, conceived in the hope of making the cash registers rattle and getting bums on seats. Poetry has replaced stand-up comedy as the new rock and roll, was the unofficial strapline. Guess how that worked out? Ever since Robert Conquest's New Lines anthology was followed by A. Alvarez's The New Poetry, there's been a compulsion among literary commentators to identify succeeding groups, movements, and poetic schools, to the point where vintages now come along with suspicious regularity. The New Generation class of 94 was followed in 2004 by The Next Generation, with a further iteration bearing the same name being rolled out 10 years later. That decade interval, too short and too chronologically convenient to be meaningful. The repeated epithet sounding more and more like a list of sequels from the Star Trek franchise. However, in retrospect, I do think some kind of shift in poetic sensibilities and temperament occurred in the late 80s and early 90s and was significant enough to justify its label. A shift that two Mexican poets and translators, Carlos López Beltrán and Pedro Serrano, described as well as any in the introduction to their anthology, The Lamb Generation. Having lived in Britain during that period, and as outsiders with a relatively non-partisan perspective, it seems they were well placed to witness the changing social fabric of the UK and observe the subsequent poetic response. In Gulf Streams, the introductory essay to that comprehensive anthology, they characterized new generation poetry as the poetry of public spaces, a poetry which, either consciously or unconsciously, sought to establish an open dialogue with society in general. Undoubtedly, Thatcherism had played its part, with high-octane politics and protest being played out at street level on a daily basis against a post-colonial, post-industrial backdrop in a country experiencing the death of the national consensus, as editors Hulse, Kennedy, and Morley put it in their own New Gen anthology, the imaginatively entitled The New Poetry. In their introduction, they also acknowledged the idea of Englishes at work in the field, as opposed to one standard and dominant English. Elsewhere, the vocabularies of the media, of advertising, technology, computing, materialism, and disposability had entered the poetic lexicon and the poetic attitude. The lightweight, portable, and user-friendly CD had replaced the heavy and worthy obligations of the long-playing album. If you didn't like a track, you could just aim the remote and skip it. Cappuccino society had finally reached Huddersfield, even if it hadn't brought any cappuccino with it. And the extrovert, outward-facing, comfortably demotic, unashamedly demonstrative, public-oriented, set-piece poem was the result. In line with the improved production values of other arts and the heightened expectations of audiences, the poetry reading, once a slightly vulgar sideshow to the printed page, had also evolved and was now a slicker and smoother event. Ticket holders, no longer satisfied by the sight and sound of the drunk old wordsmith, gravy down his tie, off mic, chewing through his latest work in progress till long after the last bus. On the style of writing, irony and cynicism were in, but ornate satire was out. An Oxbridge excrescence, according to Don Patterson, vox popped on the day we all gathered for a publicity photograph behind the Poetry Society's plate glass frontage, like mannequins in a not very fashionable shop window. A photograph which seems to have been permanently deleted or suppressed, by the way, not even retrievable through the deepest Google search or petitions to its commissioners. New Generation didn't represent an outright rejection of modernism, as some tried to claim, but engagement certainly appeared preferable to estrangement, and poetic features inherited from the likes of Hardy, Auden, Larkin, and Bishop were more evident in this cohort of siblings than anything from the Eliot and Pound side of the family. I'm generalizing, of course. Not everybody wanted to stand in the spotlight or broadcast to the precinct, and the municipal environment will never be a comfortable or appropriate arena for some poets. Another new generation generalization, but one backed up by actual poems, for example, in the work of Carol Ann Duffy, Sujata Bhatt, and even in the lugubrious Peter Redding, was an underlying tone of empathy in the work, or a prevailing register of sympathy for those at the wrong end of an unsympathetic political regime, articulated through observational description, dramatic monologues, and at times a plain spokenness of thought and feeling. A poetry about and on behalf of others, not to be confused with the identity literature of our current era, with its emphasis on the predicament of the writer, him or herself, or to others in the same situation. But I've strayed off topic here. What interests me in the context of this lecture is the relationship between those original new generation poets to the academic institutions of the UK. Because by my calculations, at the time, only three or four of them, of us, held anything like a meaningful position within a university, and only one or two held a full academic appointment. Of the rest, most were freelance writers, scratching a living through commissions, short-term residencies, council-run workshop groups, occasional reviewing, and ad hoc teaching jobs with the Arvon Foundation, etc., while others had careers, or at least jobs, in education, publishing, arts administration, or some of the people-centered roles in the social services sector. I don't know how different that made us from poets of preceding decades. Most of the recognized and anthologized poets of the 20th century had been university employees, and just as many hadn't. Hill, Hughes, Heaney, and Harrison, the four horsemen of the apocalypse, make interesting comparisons. Hill being a university man from beginning to end, Heaney being comfortable on either side of the academic perimeter, and Hughes and Harrison choosing to keep their distance by and large once their own education was complete. And although most of the new generation, at least those of us who are still writing and still alive, are now on the payroll of one educational establishment or another, it wasn't anything like an expected or even foreseeable destination at the time. The comparison I'd make then is with those subsequent generations of poets for whom a job within an English department, or more commonly a creative writing department, is either a welcome inevitability or a necessary milestone in their progression as writers. The model has become particularly Americanized. In the US, a poet's occupation, which university or college they teach at and at what level, is just as much a part of their professional CV as the books they've published, the praises they've received, and the prizes they've won. There's even an organization to represent them, the great behemoth that is AWP, the misspelt acronym of the Association of Writers and Writing Programs, whose annual conference invites over 2,000 presenters to give over 500 presentations and attracts up to 15,000 delegates. I was one of them this year in Portland, Oregon, and can confirm it is the most extraordinary gathering, with opportunities for networking that make the tap rooms of Fitzrovia and the coffee houses of Bloomsbury look like the tap rooms of Fitzrovia and the coffee houses of Bloomsbury. AWP is a portrait of poetry as industry in a state of overproduction, and the living proof, if we ever needed it, that far more people are interested in writing the stuff than they are reading it. Allied to which, anyone concerned that too many trees are laying down their lives for the sake of printed matter would have been horrified upon setting foot in the book fair in Exhibition Hall B. A vast hangar-sized space housing over 800 merchandising stalls and stands, a veritable temple to deforestation and arboricide. But whatever else it suggests, most significantly, it confirms that in the US, the writer, and especially the poet, is now predominantly a creature of the educational environment, habituated to its practices, its calendar, and its vocabularies. A similar thing is happening in the UK. By definition, I'm part of it. And I think it's worth considering what such a situation means for poets, what it means for universities, and what it means for poetry. For poets, it certainly means security. Many universities use graduate employment as a metric of achievement and as a criterion for ranking, but it's an algorithm that tends to disadvantage creative writing departments, especially ones turning out successful novelists, for whom an actual day job is a mark of failure. There's a very simple reason J.K. Rowling isn't teaching a fantasy fiction module at Goldsmiths and Kazuo Ishiguro isn't head of school at St. Andrews. The case for poets is somewhat different, though, because even high visibility and public recognition doesn't necessarily translate into a living wage, especially for poets who don't or won't or can't do anything but write poems. In that scenario, a post at an educational institution can mean regular guaranteed income. And in the US, where a good healthcare plan is the holy grail of employment benefits, a job in education can be the literal difference between life and death. How long before that situation is also true in the UK? And the rewards aren't just financial. A poet in a university department takes part in a literary and intellectual dialogue with both colleagues and students that would be difficult to find elsewhere. That conversation with students is particularly important. The poet gets older year on year, but the students stay the same age and bring with them renewed sets of cultural reference points, including their own reading lists. They even bring new definitions about what constitutes or does not constitute poetry, full stop. And as a writer, it's a privilege to have access to those changing coordinates and shifting boundaries. A privilege also to challenge beliefs and offer alternative perspectives, essential duties in the echo chamber of contemporary society, and to disagree with students who would prefer or even demand that literature does not stray beyond a set of personal reassurances or political validations, and to push back against university governances who might pander to those positions. In terms of those changing reference points, it's been interesting to note over the past few years how many newly enrolled students are more familiar with certain internet incubated personalities operating in the category of poetry than they are with some of the most respected and affirmed literary poets of this or any era. All part of an exciting sea change, we're told, in the transmission and dissemination of poetry, by which emerging talents are short-circuiting conventional publication methods and sidestepping traditional editorial processes. In this redrawn landscape, gatekeepers are figures to be reviled, though of course the best gatekeepers open gates as often as they close them. Connected to that topic, one news item that has gained currency in recent months is the story of a dramatic spike in poetry sales. Suffice it to say, don't get too excited. Because while it probably is true that the civilian population has become marginally less uninterested in the slim volume of late, the percentage upswing is largely accounted for by a single person, one Rupi Kaur, whose vast and rapid commercial success has spawned many imitators. In turn, those imitators have been encouraged by publishing houses quick to monetize the musings of poetic doodlers for whom the creative use of language is something of an occupational inconvenience. Too much applauding of the sentiment and nowhere near enough scrutiny of the approach. An approach characterized by a type of fortune cookie wisdom grafted onto corny aphorisms. Ezra Pound, from his ABC of reading, a people that grows accustomed to sloppy writing is a people in the process of losing grip on itself. But while I might not be a big fan of this kind of work, I don't necessarily blame it or its perpetrators for exploiting what might crudely be described as a gap in the market. That blame might be shared with the poetic art form itself and its general drift towards inaccessibility and its gradual withdrawal from the public domain and common ground, leaving behind empty plots and vacant premises from where counterfeiters and rogue traders are now selling hand-over-fist quantities of mass-produced imitations. Geoffrey Hill's celebrated retort to the charge that his work was difficult, life is difficult, was all well and good in the moment, but it didn't really explain why one impenetrable conundrum must be met by another, or why poetry shouldn't engage with the next level of difficulty, which is to be clear. Readers, don't be intimidated or made to feel foolish by poets whose work is inexplicably obscure. They're probably first-rate thinkers, but lower-rank writers, for whom the challenge of textual clarity is a difficulty too far. But revere those poets who bring entangled complexity into lucid focus. Anne Carson's autobiography of Red with its proemium and testimonia, with its multiple perspectives, shadow narratives, classical references, framing devices, Roman numerals, mock interviews, italics, quotes, appendices, subheadings, and fragments might sound like an unapproachable proposition, but at no point in that book will the thoughtful reader say, "I don't understand what she means." And if it's the job of the poet to recommend poetry titles, it is the job of the poet to make such recommendations. I would put Pascal Petit's Mama Amazonica and Shivani Ramlachand's Everyone Knows I Am a Haunting and Brenda Shaughness's The Octopus Museum in that same class of deep perspicacity. At a panel discussion at a recent poetry conference at Princeton University, the poet's right to difficulty was defended through the extended metaphor of interpersonal relationships. Expressed in those terms, demanding that a poem be easy, it was argued, is like demanding that a person be easy, sexually speaking, or to use the local vernacular, that a person puts out. So a reader who expects a poem to give away everything on a first reading is like a person, a man, most likely, who expects another person, a woman, most likely, to go all the way on a first date. And because the comparison aligned itself with agreed values about human dignity and gender politics, it was an analogy that drew spontaneous approval. But towards the end of that session, rising and gliding out, I wandered off by myself, and in the mystical, moist night air, and from time to time, it occurred to me that the very opposite was just as true, if not more so, i.e., it's the impossible poem that behaves like the sexually domineering man of the traditional gender stereotype, expecting not just one, but a whole harem of readers to consent to his requests, conform to his expectations, and confirm his prowess. As for the utterly incomprehensible poem, it insists upon a truly humiliating degree of promiscuity, one that mocks and demeans through its refusal to acknowledge the reader as an intelligent equal. And if the job of the poet in the university is to steer students between the treacherous poles of mundanity on one side and impenetrability on the other, which is partly how I interpret my own teaching duties, then a further task is to encourage students to look beyond the programs, modules, principles, and attitudes associated with their center of learning. At Oxford, I don't have much interaction with the students. The lectures are the headline requirement. So if I am speaking to undergraduates, it's usually from this lectern across a buffer zone between the podium and the front row of seats. I think the physical layout was designed to discourage stage diving by some of the more extrovert professors of poetry over the years. During his first appointment to the chair, Matthew Arnold was a particularly active crowd surfer, apparently, encouraged by the sea of hands and being borne aloft by ecstatic students celebrating his radical decision to lecture in English rather than Latin. But I have chosen to give a workshop every year, and in doing so have been surprised, firstly, by the uptake. There is a great desire here to write poetry. And secondly, by the historical tone of some of the presented work. And when I act as a judge in four university-based poetry competitions, the Sir Roger Newdigate Prize, the Lord Alfred Douglas Memorial Prize, the Prize for an English Poem on a Sacred Subject, and the John Stalworthy Poetry Prize, it's noticeable how antique many of the entries are. That's not a criticism of quality, by the way, simply an observation about style. It might have something to do with the competition requirements. One seeks to reward the best composition in English verse, whatever that is. Another solicits a sonnet or a poem written in strict rhyming meter. But tonally speaking, it would seem to be a consequence of the poetry the students are channeling and imitating. Like all art, poetry is a reactive medium. What comes out is a version of what goes in. So if you're mainly reading Arthur Hugh Clough, guess what your poems are going to sound like? In that scenario, the role of the practicing poet is to expose students to poetry which hasn't yet found its way onto the examined syllabus and to acquaint them with the current field of activity. A university also promises, inter alia, admin support, possibly, books, remember them, opportunities for research, technology, and more importantly, technological assistance, access to grants, bursaries, the stationery cupboard, subsidized meals, and a parking permit handy for city center shopping trips. And all those possibilities and perks, in combination with the intellectual and cultural blessings I've been outlining, are not just welcome benefits, but useful distractions, especially to poets of an introspective nature who might otherwise spend all day in their attics or treehouses going stir-crazy and mouldy, their poems becoming mad or stale. But what are the disadvantages? Most poets aren't cut out for work full stop. That's why they've gone into poetry in the first place. Preferring to make unusual shapes and patterns out of words and daydreams, rather than face the overwhelming logic and overpowering reason required by conventional and gainful employment. They are opt-outers who have pinned their hopes on the incidental. If you'll allow me, for the first and last time in 4 years, to quote one of my own poems. Believe me, it's been agony. Or people who medalist with makings, as Langland puts it in Piers Plowman, and whose minds aren't necessarily of an analytical persuasion. That might be lazy typecasting, but it's certainly true that teaching and writing aren't always mutually beneficent, if only for the reasons that most human brains seem to have a finite capacity for language on a daily basis. And when that day has been taken up with assessing poems, talking about poems, reading about poems, writing about poems, plus all the other bureaucratic language needed to satisfy the systemized and operational activities of the latter-day university, writing a poem of your own doesn't feel like a desirable or achievable activity. Worse, after several years of creative institutionalization and limited contact with the world beyond the boundary patrolled by cruising campus security vehicles and scrutinized by the fully rotational heads of CCTV cameras, poets often begin writing poems of an institutionalized nature, designed to appeal to a handful of critics and/or a coterie of colleagues, specialists in restrictive codes and occupants of neighboring offices. In the spring of 2000, I taught at the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop. The location was remote and the atmosphere rarefied. Among the staff, something of a commune or bunker mentality had developed, and the students fell prey to the same autonomous mindset, only seeking approval from their immediate tutors and classmates. As one of my workshoppers put it, when I suggested he amend a line into something resembling intelligible English, "The way I see it, no one's going to read this crap." In his case, it was true. Although the students did want to publish books, because a book of poems was the equivalent of a teaching certificate, and with a teaching certificate, a student could get a job in a creative writing department, maybe even at Iowa. As we all know, or should know, interfamilial reproduction has freakish and unhealthy consequences. And if that's an unkind analogy, what isn't in doubt is a kind of poetic cloning that takes place through the creative writing departments of universities. Inevitable in a system where tutors hand out grades, prizes, and letters of recommendation, and inevitably tend to favor those whose literary ideologies resemble their own. At Iowa, certainly during my brief stint there, narrative poets and formalists, for example, were thought of as laggards or neocons, and were not expecting anything like top marks or lavish praise. On a lesser scale, something similar takes place in the UK via the REF, the Research Excellence Framework, and through other impact evaluation systems by which institutions are measured and ranked. As far as creative writing is concerned, the REF represents something of a conundrum. On the one hand, even if a university's in-house authors are not contributing to learned periodicals or peer-reviewed journals, most of us tend to turn out books on a fairly regular basis, some of which go some way towards meeting REF criteria. But research isn't always what we want to do, or what we do best, or what we do at all. And ransacking the archives and databases of your own imagination is something that's hard to quantify or prove. And there's a consequence for the work as well, arguably a more important consideration. Over the last 5 or 6 years, in reading, reviewing, and judging, I've come across an increasing number of books which are research projects first and poetry collections second. Refable, it's now a word, refable undertakings with the line endings added afterwards, so to speak, or collections which include a good number of poems that appear to have been developed out of study rather than, say, fancy, or as Auden called it, love. It's not a problem per se. Research initiatives can prompt the poetic imagination and provoke creative linguistic responses just as effectively as a Greek urn or an archaic torso of Apollo. But there is a suspicion with some collections of the cart coming before the horse, and it's frustrating and or disappointing to turn to the notes section at the back of a book and find that a particularly bewildering poem was written for a hospital trust in Wolverhampton and is the culmination of 3 years' work evaluating the medical records of outpatients in the podiatry clinic, hence the baffling references to ingrowing toenails and inoperable bunions. Who wants to read endless poems and collections that are only activated by the terms and conditions section or the small print at the bottom of the page? Clearly, some poems are designed to operate in tandem with accompanying annotation, The Wasteland being an obvious and famous example, or David Jones's The Sleeping Lord, which is more notes than it is poem. Fair enough. But neither of those poems carry the watermark of an employment contract or a certificate of qualification. Similar questions might be asked of the creative writing PhD, whereby the poetic portion often ends up between the covers of a published book, with the academic essay portion, in some cases, the activating or explanatory element put to one side. To reiterate, it doesn't matter how work is generated, so I offer this as a caution rather than a criticism. But achieving a high academic grade and operating effectively in the world of published poetry are not necessarily the same thing. Just to be clear, I'm not initiating a campaign to have poets evicted from their university offices or have their ID cards confiscated. It is my contention that for the good of the art, fellowships, residencies, visiting professorships, and fractional appointments are the healthiest forms of working arrangement for both parties. I don't want to see poets operating as the vagrants of literature, dwindling away in isolation or poverty. No matter how much the romantic idea persists that suffering is a necessary precursor to inspiration. Nevertheless, it's essential that poetry is capable of making itself heard outside the university circuit and able to communicate with the informed reader and the inquiring listener in a wider territory and be in a fit state to compete with museums and art galleries and cinemas and sculpture parks and theatres and prose fiction and non-fiction and the better TV channels and the more enlightened radio networks for a share of the market. Therefore, for the sake of poets, please do offer them a job for all those mutual benefits I listed earlier. But for the sake of poetry, please kick them out by the middle of each week, around Wednesday lunchtime. So whether they like it or not, they have to set off up the road, seeing things and bumping into people who might prove to be their subjects and, who knows, even their readers. And what should poets actually be doing during their 2.5 days a week on university premises? It's a peculiar quirk of the British education system that the further up the ladder a person climbs, the fewer qualifications they seem to require. Friends of mine who were teachers in junior and secondary schools around the UK have completed rigorous training courses, jumped through innumerable bureaucratic hoops, and been subjected to all kinds of checks and authorizations. But here I am, without a single teaching certificate or anything like it to my name. The automatic assumption, it seems, is that as well as writing the stuff, authors, and especially poets, will also be able to give useful instruction on the creative process. An assumption that seems largely correct, probably as a consequence of their own learning experience. Nearly all the poets of my age or era, during their unofficial apprenticeship to the art, were active members of writing groups or writing workshops. Informal and unofficial R&D poetry laboratories of a type, where as well as testing the operational capabilities of our own poetic creations, we observed an instructor in action, to the extent that we weren't just being schooled as poets, but also as tutors. And it's those tutoring methods, along with their associated vocabularies, exercises, philosophies, and coaching tactics that we've successfully imported into university and college settings. Some poets actually claim that discussing the craft of poetry with novices is part of the ancient role of being a poet, as if we were members of the magic circle or adepts in a secret society, imparting the arcane tricks of the trade to those who would follow the path. Undergraduate modules and courses based around the workshop model are now a well-established feature at most universities, though not here at Oxford, at least at a graded or examined level. Certainly, there are numerous extracurricular and out-of-hours poetry workshops, groups, and societies, some of them dating back centuries. And of course, the MA and diploma programs in the Department for Continuing Education, but nothing located at the core of the English language and literature degree, within the auspices of the largest English department in Britain. When I've asked why this is the case, I've been given a number of answers, ranging from the conceptual to the practical, but the one I liked best was, it would be too popular. To some extent, it's none of my business. I have one more official duty, attend senior in July, after which I'll be well into my new job, attending to the poetic needs of 67.3 million people. At the same time, as the holder of a post which goes back to 1708, a post which includes the words Professor, Poetry and Oxford in its title, I feel entitled to an opinion, authorized to make it from this platform, and mandated to speak on behalf of those students who are keen to write. On this front, Oxford is obstinately unaligned, not just with the rest of the country, but with the rest of the world, with most top-ranked universities offering writing programs that are, yes, popular, but beneficial to many aspects of learning. They're also lucrative. Vice-chancellors don't have to sanction investment in a radio telescope or a particle accelerator or a squillion terabytes of cloud storage to get a creative writing department up and running. And compared with biochemistry or molecular physics or even fine art and film studies, poetry is, presumably, a relatively cheap date. Perhaps it would be argued that analytical writing and critical reading, the staples of UCAS course code Q300, is no less creative than composing a poem or a short story. But at some fundamental level, I continue to believe that through attempting to make poetry, those who prefer to assess and evaluate are brought to a new level of understanding and insight. And if any such attempts, even if any such attempts result in a spectacular flop. In other fields, those who sit in judgment are often denied the experience of trying their hand because the art forms they comment upon are far too complex or time-consuming or expensive to produce. Nobody is going to give an opinionated critic from the Architectural Review the chance to design and construct a billion-pound corporate headquarters in the square mile just to say, nah, 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 nah. But poetry can offer that opportunity without too much fuss and palaver and with limited collateral damage. Perhaps there's a feeling that a practice-based degree is more in keeping with the training courses and vocational qualifications offered at lower tiers of the educational hierarchy, though, ironically, given the dissolution of the polytechnics, that's the direction education has travelled of late, with students hungry for more experiential learning, in keeping with the world they operate in. I'm referring to the extent to which the means of production have been disseminated into the hands of the many, making us all journalists, all filmmakers, all photographers, all builders, all DJs, all master chefs, etc., etc. Once the prerogative of the validated expert, the technologies by which artistic excellence is accomplished are now cheaply available to the general population, with access to them seen as neither a right nor a privilege, just a given. Added to which, education is now a shopping service and a buyer's market, and what the student population desire or demand, universities tend to supply eventually or risk losing their customers. As to the accusation that poetry or other forms of writing can't be objectively graded, nonsense. It's perfectly possible as long as a clear framework of expectation is laid out in advance. This is my last lecture. I'm going back to the beginning, regressing myself via a cycle of significant personal anniversaries I've experienced recently. It's 40 years since I was sitting in a temporary classroom at Combe Valley High School in West Yorkshire, the first purpose-built comprehensive school in the north of England. The classroom went by the name of Elliot One, a glorified shed, not named in honour of Thomas Stearns himself, but after the brand of modular porter cabin craned in to accommodate the 1,700-strong and expanding student population. Elliot One was supposed to be a temporary teaching space, but had become a permanent feature and part of the school's crumbling and flaking infrastructure it wouldn't surprise me if it's still there. As an indication of Colne Valley High School's demographic makeup in the late 1970s, it boasted a small farm where students grew potatoes and learned rudimentary animal husbandry. It wasn't unusual to be going home on the school bus, sitting next to somebody with a cardboard box full of newly hatched chicks on their lap, or a pitchfork propped between their knees. And timetabled lessons in the small holding were referred to as double digging. So it wouldn't be fair on Colne Valley's dedicated and occasionally exasperated staff to characterize the school as a failed enterprise. There was a decent education on offer for anyone prepared to engage with the subjects, get their head down, and be alert to the possibilities of learning. I wasn't one of those students until my English teachers, Mr. Jeffrey Bamford, I'm proud to mention you by name, sir, and Mr. Mike Shaw, proud to mention you by name as well, sir, handed out copies of a book called Worlds. This book, in fact. In fact, this very copy. Apologies, it should have been handed in. And it wasn't. My only mitigation is that I very quickly felt a sentimental attachment to it, even if I didn't recognize it as a gateway or signpost at the time, which is the role I've retrospectively bestowed on it as a pivotal artifact in my own personal creation myth. Worlds is a poetry anthology of seven modern poets, modern at the time anyway, and yes, all male and all white, edited by Jeffrey Summerfield. Its appeal to me initially, and probably part of its genius, was that it contained pictures. Black and white photographs of a cool-looking, tattooed and ponytailed Tom Gunn rocking a pair of hipster jeans, a studded leather wristband, and cowboy boots. Of Charles Corsley, who looked a bit like my granddad, in a house that looked a bit like my grandparents' house, with the same tiled hearth and pottery figurines on the mantelpiece. And of a fresh-faced, agricultural-looking Seamus Heaney in rural Ireland, going about in a peat bog or wandering across an overgrown field with his wife and kids, and at a ceilidh or maybe a wake in someone's front room under a single bare light bulb. The point being made, I suppose, was that rather than being painted portraits or carved busts of canonized and long-dead literary demigods, these poets looked like people I knew and recognized, real-life human beings in real situations, no one to feel threatened or intimidated by. So, if this bloke Adrian Mitchell wore a shirt like that, he couldn't be so difficult, could he? And how unfathomable could this chap Edwin Morgan be if he had to walk up a urine-stained concrete staircase to get to his flat? He lived in a flat. In and amongst those images, each section began with an essay or an interview with the poet, which served as an introduction to the poems and the person. In later years, in a phase of literary insecurity, I would fall for the idea that the text was the text and that biography and other external or extraneous circumstances should not intrude. But here were the poets explaining, ushering, being approachable, making themselves available, inviting readers into their worlds, just as they'd invited a photographer into their kitchens, studies, gardens, and local pubs. And into their poems. Normally the last element of the book I would have been interested in at that age, but via the photographs and the essays, I was curious to see what these people had to say for themselves and how poet and poem coincided. Forget the new criticism, all that could come later, if at all. Here, we were being actively encouraged to witness Heaney's wellies and his woolly jacket, to goggle at the sailor's cap from HMS Cormorant on Charles Causley's dresser, and to notice that Norman McCaig watched television and smoked fags. Worlds reassured and it humanized, which isn't to say that it took away the mystery, because for all the poets illuminated and explained, they also made fables and fashioned surprising truths and magnified the significances of the everyday. None more so than Ted Hughes, who was the only poet who had refused, or at least resisted, offering himself to the camera. In lieu of his image came half a dozen of Faye Godwin's photographs of the Colne Valley, of the Calder Valley. Locations I recognized and had always thought of as unremarkable, but suddenly appearing all moody and meaningful, alongside a short prose piece about Scout Rock, that black quarry face overshadowing the Mythemroit terrace Hughes had grown up in, shutting out the light of day and barring his passage to realms beyond, both real and imaginary. Just a slab of stone, I'd always thought whenever we'd driven past, but in the Hughes version, a vast geological barrier and psychological fault line to be challenged and overcome. But if Worlds acted as some kind of wake-up call to a lackluster 16-year-old sleepwalking his way through school, the occurrence that truly opened my eyes and my mind came in the form of the next book to be handed out, Hughes's The Hawk in the Rain. Yep, still got it. And more specifically, from the poem Bayonet Charge, an imagined description of a World War I soldier going over the top into no man's land. Recently, the centenary years of that conflict fused with the anniversary of my first reading of that poem via the line which fused itself into my memory on first reading it. The line runs, "In what cold clockwork of the stars and nations was he the hand pointing that second? In what cold clockwork of the stars and nations was he the hand pointing that second?" I couldn't make a literal paraphrase or offer a definitive explanation of it at the time, and still can't, except to say that, like the soldier in the poem, I was suddenly awake and running. And that vague feeling of self-awareness I'd experienced from time to time now had a sentence to describe it. I didn't just exist, I had consciousness. I also experienced what I remember as an incredible high voltage surge of understanding about the electrifying possibilities of language, as the sharp jolt of the poem's subtext arced from its letters into the optic nerve. Some dormant region in the brain's three-dimensional and infinitely interconnected wiring has suddenly been activated or reactivated by the two-dimensional monochromatic circuit board of the printed page. And all this without physical contact, conducted by the medium of light, or through the medium of resonating air a few months later, when Hughes read the poem from the stage of Hebden Bridge Cinema, a purely oral projection, no film necessary. Depletion by opportunist theft notwithstanding, it's a matter of great regret that books like Jeffrey Summerfield's Worlds and the earlier Voices anthologies are no longer piled high in the stockrooms of Britain's secondary schools and presented to pupils on their first day of term. Sure, books are expensive, initially at least, and certainly compared with photocopied sheets of paper handed out in lessons, or scanned poems airdropped or emailed to screens and tablets, or the flimsy, stapled together booklets distributed by our current exam boards. But books are the truer economy, because they recognize the physical satisfaction of poetry, acknowledge the symbiotic pleasure of being possessed by an object while being the possessor of it, and reinforce the connection between literature and the time-honored device by which it is most effectively delivered. And anyway, what's not to like about a pre-loved book with all its handwritten marginalia and its archaeology of ownership and its environmental credibility as a recycled artifact? In my copy of Worlds, underneath the Ted Hughes poem Thrushes, the book's previous leaseholder had written, "Birds eat to live and live to eat. They have none of man's debilitating intellectuality or his slavish adherence to rules." A comment, thank you very much, that made its way verbatim into my own exam essay. I got a B. You might call it cheating. I call it alternative tutelage. My daughter's school copy of Mice and Men was relatively unannotated, apart from inside the front cover where a former student had written, "George kills Lenny." A few years ago, I visited a well-known English public school, not a million miles away from here, actually, to give a reading and a workshop. The head of English asked if I needed a map, and when I told him that sat-nav should land me there without too many problems, he replied, "No, I mean a map of the school." I found out later that the school prides itself on having a pupil-to-acreage ratio of 1:1. I didn't envy them their landscaped environs. What you can get up to behind the boating shed at the far side of the ornamental lake, you can just as easily do round the back of Elliot 1. But I did, on behalf of many other schools I've visited, envy them their books, towers of stockpiled hardbacks, ready to be recirculated and reread. Why am I telling you this in this forum on this occasion? Because I assume that some of you here and some of you listening to the podcast of this lecture are connected with exam boards and educational policy, or have connections to decision-making bodies responsible for the design and implementation of educational curricula, or know individual decision-makers in that arena, or have dirt on those people. And I'm using my last professorial breath to ask that poetry, the reading of it, and the writing of it, be a core element of the study of English literature from start to finish. It's also my assumption that some students here will become teachers. If so, I urge you to uphold creative writing as an unignorable element of English lessons, not just as a bone thrown in the direction of the less academically gifted, or as a fluffy optional add-on, or as something to do during a power cut or detention. When Walt Whitman, or his Whitman-esque character, leaves the lecture room and goes outside, as he does in the poem I quoted earlier, and whose title I've borrowed for my presentation today, he's preferring the role of the romantic stargazer to the obedient student of cold measurements and hard maths. But no matter how soon accountable he wearies of the proofs and the figures, we shouldn't ignore the fact that, as a great follower of technological advancement and an occasional spokesman for the relationship between science and poetry, Whitman was inclined to attend the lecture in the first place. So although his journey from enclosed academic auditorium to open night skies might seem like a rejection of, or even a defection from, scholarly values, his decision feels impulsive and of the moment, a from time to time flounce out rather than a permanent or obstinate position. And if he has chosen instinct over instruction in this instance, he has at least put himself in a position to make a comparison and to set up a dialogue between knowledge and mystery. However much Whitman played the part of the independent thinker and wandering free spirit, the intellectual progressions of his era in many different disciplines were instrumental to the development of his imagination and the execution of his work. At the same time, his transition from the populated hall to a situation of solitariness reads to me as a recognition of those aspects of poetic contemplation and composition that can only be achieved individually and in a perfect silence that goes beyond auditory soundlessness. And those closing lines always send me to what I think of as their British counterpart or domestic counterpoint, the closing section of Norman Nicholson's The Pot Geranium, Nicholson being the Cumbrian poet famous for his loyalty not just to one town, but to one house, and in this instance, to one room within that house. In his bedroom in Milham, lying on his bed, the sloped ceiling overhead is no limit to his vision, and the expert earth sciences and grand geographies of the planet are no daunting restriction to his curiosity, and celestial distances are no barrier to his grasp. What he describes as the pattern, the prod, and pulse of life are all apparent in the crimson-petaled plant thriving on the windowsill. The poem ends, "And what need, therefore, to stretch for the straining kite? For kite and flower bloom in my room forever. The light that lifts them shines in my own eyes, and my body's warmth hatches their red in my veins. It is the Gulf Stream that rains down the chimney, making the soot spit. It is the trade wind that blows in the draft under the bedroom door. My ways are circumscribed, confined as a limpet to one small radius of rock. Yet I eat the equator, breathe the sky, and carry the great white sun in the dirt of my fingernails." Thank you very much.
Simon's left me the books here. I'm honoured to give the closing word of thanks after this valedictory lecture from Professor Simon Armitage. My name's Ros Ballester, and I'm chair of the English Faculty Board at Oxford University. Rather typically, Simon said, "Well, you might want to wait and hear what I say before you give the word of thanks." And I'm still very honoured. As Simon will know from working on a translation of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, it can be a challenge when you're invited to come and stay in someone's home. Expectations are high. You're expected to admire your host's taste in decor, to keep to the hours they observe, in short, to fit in. But it's also likely that your host is hoping that you might shake things up a bit, introduce new topics of conversation, let some light in. And Simon Armitage has trod and pushed that line between those demands with enormous courage and responsibility. Today, I think he's demonstrated you don't always need 2.5 days a week. 1 hour a term can make a significant intervention. Poetry has always been here at Oxford, both within and beyond the buildings of the university. Simon's brought to life, as well as questioned, poetry's agency in the modern world through a series of compelling lectures. He's brought unlikely poets into conversation with each other. He's introduced us to less well-known poetic voices. He's reflected on what techniques and styles might occupy the place of form in providing structure to poetry. He's riffed on lists and simile and their power to organize poems. but above all else, he's modelled the power of close reading to open up that reflective space, the space to reflect on and in language, even and especially in environments where unstructured information threatens to overwhelm knowledge. And I don't think it's always been easy, although he's made it look that way. The pedagogic style of the lecture can be difficult for creative writers whose inclination, I suspect, is to leave things a little looser, to maintain a certain allusiveness and elusiveness. Injecting those qualities into his lectures means that Professor Armitage has also modelled for us here at Oxford the power of those who work with poetic language to shift the norms of the ways that we teach and talk. Now, guests often think they leave no trace once they've left the building. This isn't the case, and especially not for Oxford. Our rooms are occupied with the presence of past voices. They have a resonance, some more than others, of course. And we've been extraordinarily privileged to have had Professor Armitage's voice with us for 4 years. It's most unusual for the two major posts in Britain that support the public place of poetry to fall vacant in the same year. And I'm prepared to stand corrected, but I think this might be the first occasion in which the Oxford Professor of Poetry has gone on to become the Poet Laureate. And we know, because we have had the privilege of Simon's visiting with us for these 4 years, that he's the very best advocate for this most demanding of arts. So we thank him warmly for sharing his wisdom and creativity with us, confident that the task of representing poetry as laureate is in strong hands. Can I ask you once more to put your hands together in recognition of our outgoing Professor of Poetry, Simon Armitage?